This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest this week is a professional musician. He's a Marine Corps veteran, Purple Heart recipient, and a professional public speaker with the Wounded Warrior Project. But before we get into the show, I just have a couple announcements. I do have a book on the way. A lot of you may not know this, but like many of my guests, I do have a pretty wild story myself. So I wrote a memoir about it because I've seen that sharing my story saves lives, and I'm trying to do that in as big a way as possible. So my editor currently has it for the first round of editing. We'll go through two more rounds of that, and then hopefully it will be out into the world. Because I don't have a release date for it yet, you can go to my website and subscribe to my mailing list there and also read a little bit about my background if you're unsure of what I am talking about. Also, the best way to help the show grow is first word of mouth and then also leaving a rating and review in whatever podcast platform you're using to listen to it right now, and then share it around with another curious mind who needs to hear these conversations. But without further ado, please welcome Sal Gonzalez. Thanks for coming, man. I think I want to start here with the record, right? Like I know you've been a professional musician. You've played at the Grand Ole Opry and stuff like that. But I mean, this is your first record deal, right?
Yeah, this is official. My first honest to God record deal. It's Label 22 Records. We're releasing my first EP on November 10th. With a little party going on the 11th for a release party.
And will that be?
In Nashville.
Okay. Are you playing a big show that night, or are you just having a big party somewhere?
There is a show and party component. There's going to be a little bit of both. We're still trying to work out the details because there's the Nashville Veterans Parade is on the 11th. And so we're trying to coordinate with the city of Nashville to make sure that we're all good to go and in the right spots.
That's super cool. With 22 being in the name, is that a coincidence, or is that like a suicide prevention label for vets?
It's a label for vets. So it started by my buddy, Stephen Cochran, and he was an artist in town in Nashville. Had some top 30 hits back in the mid 2000s. And I heard him on the radio telling his story. And he's a Marine, got wounded in Afghanistan, I believe. And they basically told him he wouldn't walk again. And he defied their odds and came back and had a whole music career touring the country with Big and Rich and doing cool stuff. So I called into the radio station one day and like a lunatic, I was like, "Hey, you're a Marine, I'm a Marine. You need to help me out. We play music. Let's do it." And he's like, "Yeah, dude, whatever."
No way.
Friends ever since. Yeah.
That's wild. Have you gotten to talk to him about what it was like touring with Big and Rich like that?
Yeah. He was part of that whole like music mafia stuff back in the day, man. He'd be a great person for the podcast too.
That is so freaking cool, dude. I bet he's got some fucking stories. I mean, outside of obviously the Marine Corps too, but
he's got the wildest stories I've ever heard. He's got stories that make you go like, did that really happen? And for a long time, I kind of took all of those stories with a grain of salt. You know those guys. They
storytellers.
Yeah. The storytellers. They're kings of hyperbole, as Joe Rogan would say. And I got invited. He goes, "Hey man, why don't you come out to my reunion? You can play for all my boys as we do like our reunion from our deployments." And I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I showed up and I started talking to all these Marines. And they start telling these stories too. And I'm like, whoa. That's a real story? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, I thought he was bullshitting. I thought like half of those stories were sort of kind of made up, but not really all the way true. They're like, no, all of them are honest to God truth. It all happened. Yeah, he's got some amazing stories.
That's, I'm such a bad storyteller too. Like I respect when it is a king of hyperbole doing it. Like that is, it's a craft, right? When they can suck people in. But when you find out that someone's not bullshitting with that stuff, that's neat, man. But like, you know, when you and I met a couple months ago, I think, cause you were a machine gunner, you were a Cat Marine as well, right?
Yeah. That was a lead machine gunner and a Cat Platoon.
Yeah, I had a hard time connecting the dots. Like when we started talking about your music background on how you got there from what you had described as a kid, it sounded like you were more of an artist vibe, right?
Oh yeah. I was a total hippie kid, man. I was into like ska music and rockabilly and I was into everything, and I had no intention of joining the Marine Corps. Like I was not a tough kid growing up. I wasn't an athlete. But after 9/11, I felt a calling and I was like, I need to go do something. And every time I walked into the office of like the Air Force or the Navy or the Army, they kept wanting to give me stuff. They're like, oh, you can go here. We'll send you to college and do that. I'm like, I'm here to serve. I don't want like anything other than just my chance to go serve. Like, I appreciate the college and all that. Yeah, that's a given free. I appreciate that. But they're like trying to sell me on other reasons to join the Marine Corps or to join the military. And I'm like, I don't need other reasons. Like, I'm here. Why are you wasting my time with other reasons? And I walked in the Marine recruiter and he goes, I don't think you got what it takes, man. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to prove you wrong, dummy.
Shit. I wonder how many. Little technique. Just solid sales shirt.
Yeah. How many hundreds of kids he got to enlist off of that? Like, yeah. But, and so I've got two questions here. Before that, like, were you out of high school already by the time 9/11 happened?
No, I was junior year of high school, I think.
Okay.
So when this happened. So okay. I had another couple years to graduate before I was ready to, old enough to go, you know. Turned 18 in 2003 and then graduated that summer and went to boot camp October of that year of 03.
Jeez. What? Were your aspirations before that to do the music thing?
Yeah, it's all I was ever going to do was music. I was going to work at my family owns a restaurant in East LA.
Yeah.
And so I was going to work at the family restaurant during the day and then just play in bands at night in Hollywood and doing all that. So I already had bands and stuff all the way in high school. And we were fairly popular Spanish rock band in East LA. We had we played on a few different bars on the Hollywood Boulevard and on Sunset and stuff. You know, we played the Roxy, we played the Cabin, we played a bunch of little bars in Hollywood, and we were pretty popular in East LA. We played a lot of parties there. We played a lot of like quinceañeras and birthdays and stuff like that. And then I decided I was going to join the Marine Corps. Everybody just kind of moved off and did their own things.
So the rest of your crew kind of stayed down that path?
Yeah, my guitar player, he joined the Marine Corps. And then he was a reservist for a little while and then became a cop. And now he's LAPD, getting ready to retire from doing that. The other guys are all still, I want to say they're still musicians. I don't think they're like professional musicians. I think they're doing other things now in life.
Okay. That's kind of crazy that you like probably the most circuitous path to get there. And now you're doing it. I mean, you know, 20 years later, but so
it's all I've ever known to do. So like when I got out of the Marine Corps, this is what I started doing was music again. I've told people forever, like I could be 80 years old and you will find me on a bar stool singing with a guitar. Like that's what I love to do fundamentally as a human being. Whether I get paid for it or not has nothing to do with it. I'm going to do it until I'm old.
Yeah.
Because I love it so much.
That was actually that bothered me after we got home from this storytelling workshop where I met you. Cause I was like, I wish I would have, I wish I could have heard you more. Cause you started playing, I think that first or second day when we were working on our speeches and I was like, hey man, I can't hear my screen reader. And then you stopped. But like, and then that night when you guys went to the open mic, I was so exhausted because I'd been up so early and then like was like, I need to work on my speeches. I didn't go and I was kicking myself for it. I was like, I wish I could have heard you play more because like that little bit that I heard, it was just, it's so neat, man.
I don't blame you at all for not going to that open mic night, especially as like a blind person. I'm sure your hearing and stuff gets sensitive by the end of the day. And then if you're in a bar, people are screaming and clinking drinks and yelling and there's speakers and music. Yeah. I don't blame you for not going to that sort of joint with us, but you did miss a good time.
Oh, I heard. I know I did.
There was a dude who I can only describe as Skeletor dressed as Richard Simmons. So he had like a purple fro, but was dressed like Richard Simmons. And he was like, so thin. He looked frail. Like he shouldn't
be. Sickly.
Yeah. But God bless him. He was out there doing it.
Yeah, I know. You guys had stories at breakfast that next morning. And I was like, aside, cause I was already bummed. I was like, I should have gone to listen to the music. But then after that, I was like, I messed up, but it is. Like you said, it's loud environments like that, dude. They get me. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't blame you even in the slightest. I don't go on hikes when people invite me. You know what I mean?
It's weird how that guy with one leg is like, fuck, I don't want to walk, dude.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first stepfather, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
People are like, hey, we should go on a run sometime. It's like, you want a run? I ain't running from nobody but the IRS and the police.
Yeah. You're crossing a line now trying to act like there's nothing wrong here. You're like,
exactly.
Yeah.
I appreciate you treating me normal, but there's a limit.
Yeah. Yeah. You got nothing to prove, but.
Yeah. And then, no, man, music's one of those things that I fell in love with early on. My dad was a bass player. And so like, I was around it early and I wanted to do it early and I had access to it early and I was always fascinated with how people could make their voice do fun things, like the way Usher or whatever on whoever on the radio would make their voice go super high or super low or the, in between. And it, I grew up just trying to mimic all of those voices that I heard. And eventually I got halfway decent at it. Now, I just can't help but do it. I'm just real lucky that I'm able to make a career out of it.
Ben, you write your own songs and stuff too, don't you?
Yeah. I try not to sing anybody else's music.
I just, we were supposed to go to it was a Gavin Abcock concert, and I'd never heard of the guy, but you know, for live music, this was just this past weekend, and you know, his opener, it started raining on us. It was an outside theater and it started raining on us. And his opener was obviously losing the battle, even though I couldn't see what was going on, you know, with the weather. And then with everything he was saying is like his little rant in between songs, I could tell he was losing the battle and he knew it. And he started just doing covers of popular bands. And I was like, oh, he's totally lost it now. Like it takes away.
He's just trying to get the crowd back on his side, baby.
Yeah. And I felt it. And I was like, this poor bastard, like this is sad now. But,
I don't know what's worse, watching somebody eat it on stage playing music or watching somebody eat it on stage doing stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure which one's more painful. I think stand-up comedy might be more painful because at least with music, people are like, at least you're trying.
Yeah, and it still sounds good. Whereas like if you don't have the energy of the crowd with stand-up, like you're screwed.
Yeah, they hate you.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, man. But I was going to ask you, like, because if your dad was a musician too, is everyone in your family creative like that? Or is that just kind of something that you developed?
I think creativity sort of dances through our family a little bit in that my grandfather played some guitar, but wasn't like a career musician, right? Like he was a total hobbyist. My dad tried to make the bass into a career, but could never stay consistent enough to like make the transition into like a full-time musician or whatnot. And I have other family members, some cousins and stuff, that they started bands and they play music. And for the most part, everybody is just hobbyists. My mom sings a little bit, but just with the radio. I'm really the only one in the family that's like a serious musician, other than my brother. And my brother is like a hip hop guy. He makes beats and raps and does all that stuff. He's super talented, but just in a different sort of avenue.
Yeah. It's interesting to me kind of just getting to analyze like where people come from, especially like that, like, you know, playing the Grand Ole Opry is one thing and a huge accomplishment and like one-offs like that. But I mean, getting a freaking record deal, it feels like from the outside, that feels like cartoonish. That is like, hey, yeah, you have made it, right? You've done all the things. And it's just,
There's still a long way to go. It's a lot of it's luck. A lot of it is knowing the right people and being in the right place at the right time and having the talent to stand on its own when you're called upon, right?
Yeah.
But I still got a long way to go, man. Like nobody knows who the hell I am. I'm just some dude. I'm just a guy with a missing a leg playing music on stage. If I ain't good, like my career is not going to go very far. You know what I mean? So I'm proud of this music that we put out. And that's saying a lot for me because I hate myself and I don't like anything that I do. So the fact that I like it even slightly means it should be pretty good.
Yeah. That's like the curse of, I think, anyone who takes what they're doing seriously. It's like, I get, and who also has their ego in check, like where it's not ever going to be good enough. So I think that's a good sign, right? And like, obviously I've met you, you're a very genuine person, but like, I think internally for you, that's a sign that like, all right, I'm on the right track here in terms like as a human, right? But
Yeah, and it's one of those ones where I'm like, I'm proud to show other people. I'm like, yes, go check this. I can't wait for you guys to hear it because I'm excited about it. For the first time, I'm excited about my own music, which is like, it's not a thing for me. So
yeah,
we got with a good producer. His name's Eddie. Hold on. If I don't remember his name properly, I'm going to be upset with myself. So Eddie Gore. I was going to say it correctly, but shout out Eddie. I wanted to make sure I said it right. Cause I knew he was going to be angry at me.
Yeah.
So he's like a Grammy nominated producer. He's super good. He works out of the RCA studios in Nashville and I got to record there, which was awesome. And yeah, it's a good time.
So was it your band? Cause I thought you do solo stuff too.
I do all solo stuff. I write all my own stuff on just my guitar. And then I bring that to Eddie, my producer, and he hires a band to fill in the blanks.
Okay. So it's like, it's all like session musicians for that stuff.
Yeah. It's all session musicians. And these guys are some of the most talented, like on the spot musicians you've ever heard in your life. Like you give them a chart of music, they play it not only the way it's written, but then they ad lib on top of that. It's amazing. You sit there, they play a whole song. They've only ever heard me play it on guitar once. And so like the guitar player, he kind of knows what's going on because he has my example, but everybody else has to imagine their own parts as I'm playing. And then they just like 5 seconds later, they walk into the studio and they play it note for note from beginning to end in almost a single take.
And so you don't have sheet music for them. They literally are just, they're that talented.
Yeah. Well, it's not sheet music. There's this thing that they use called the Nashville number system. And that basically uses numbers in place of the music notes to let people know where they should be going. Cause there's like a pattern in music. There's only, you know, A through G. And it has to do with music theory. Without getting too nerdy about it, it just looks like a bunch of numbers. It's a lot like reading music, but easier. And they made that up in Nashville because there was a lot of guys that knew how to play music really well, but just couldn't read the notes. You know what I mean? So they taught them how to do this Nashville number system. And now it's like the way people record in Nashville. It's pretty wild because you just see a page full of ones and twos and fours and fives. And they're like, what the hell is all this? And they're like, don't worry. It's like a six and a half. You'll get it.
And that's all relative to the key.
Relative to the key. The key is the root chord is one and everything else around it is numbered differently depending on the melody of the song.
Okay. Dude, that is so, I would love to be a fly on the wall for that and just see. I mean, even when, you know, because I play a little guitar. I am horrible at it, but like when I'm trying to learn stuff from videos and hearing these guys just improvise me, like, yeah, this is how you extend this pentatonic scale into this. And it's just, it's mesmerizing. And it's like live music, obviously, is always, it's 10 times better. So it's, wow.
Yeah, watching Billy Strings talk about guitar playing as he plays guitar is just mesmerizing. But you're right. Being like, I play guitar halfway decently, and these guys, these people in these studios are so talented. And there's so many of them here in town. That's the messed up part. Is that there's like, you throw a rock and you're going to hit 10 great guitar players. And not just great, the best guitar players you've ever heard in your life.
Yeah, that's another thing, man, where like, if you're getting deals there, like you're standing out amongst, that's like, you know, going to Nashville is like, you've gone from your college football team to a pro football team. And if you're standing out there, like it's so cool. And obviously it's like romanticized that's the place where you break out to, but yeah. I had a guy on here recently, which we didn't really get to talk about. He was a session musician, but you know, he basically lost like his entire life to his addiction and some crimes that he committed. And then, you know, is now like a celebrity rehab guy. So we spent all of our time talking about that and kind of, you know, parsing out the science of addiction and his beliefs on it and some of the stuff that he's doing as opposed to his past as a musician. But he recorded with like Elton John and Queen and stuff. And it's just, again, every time when I talk to people like that, I want to know. I like knowing how things work. And so it's just, it's, I don't know. It's, I could sit here and nerd out about it and ramble forever, but I just, with, I don't think you mentioned the name of the album earlier, did you?
It's going to be self-titled. It's just going to be Sal Gonzalez. So self-titled, and it'll be out on November 10th, the Marine Corps birthday, 250th.
Sweet. Do you have a website where that's going to be? Yeah.
Hey, bro.
Yet. I've got a, my website is peglegsongs.com. Peglegsongs.com.
Is it for real?
I kid you not, sir.
I really love that.
My website.
Okay.
Eventually, you'll be able to go to like salgonzalez.com and it'll take you to the website. But Pegleg Song is the one we're working on. I'm working on getting everything to cross over. Okay. So I had salgonzalez.com and it was done like by
professional. This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Professionals, and it was great for a while, but I needed to update it, and I didn't know how to update all of that old stuff, so I just went ahead and found a new domain, and I think I found a fun one.
No, I like this one better, so I think you should keep it, but...
Oh, it's mine forever. Nobody's ever getting this beat.
Yeah, that's the best, man. It's, but, you know, before I took you down this tangent, we were talking about, you know, you'd come up in high school, and then 9/11 happened, and then... your recruiter, even though you were looking to go, also did played the ego thing and got you to enlist. Did you go in? And I'm asking this, I'm curious, you know, I guess I started talking to a Marine Corps recruiter when I was 16, but I always knew I was going to go into the military. But when I started talking to the Marine Corps recruiter, like in at that point in time through when I was 18 and actually went in, like, my idea of serving was you do that in the infantry. Like you can do 90% of the rest of the military's jobs as a civilian. Like if you're going to serve, it should be in the infantry. Is that how you felt?
I wanted to do that. I've only ever wanted to do two jobs in the military. The first one, because I grew up in East LA. There's a lot of guns in East LA, but my family was very reserved and conservative even though my dad had a gun and shot regularly because he believed in training and all that stuff, he kept me totally away from it.
Oh, okay.
He didn't want me to have any experience with shooting, any experience with guns, any experience, just nothing. And so I was like, I want to be a gunsmith. I want to fix the guns that the grunts are out there shooting. And so I signed up originally to do that, to be a gunsmith, but... the waiting list to do that was like a year and a half long, and I was trying to go as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And so I thought to myself at 18, I said, what's the next best job that would let me play with big, awesome guns like that? And I thought to myself, machine gunner.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it is a cartoonish job. It really, I try and like explain that to people. And I was like, it is the fact that they will give... an 18-year-old a Mark 19. Like, it's fucking wild. It's just...
Oh, it's my favorite machine gun so much. Okay. It's my favorite designed machine gun. My favorite machine gun is the 50, and my favorite machine gun to shoot is a 240. But that Mark, yes, it's ridiculous that they gave us these things. They just let us have this automatic machine gun that shoots grenades.
And yes, people listening, you heard that correctly. It is a belt-fed 40-millimeter grenade launcher. So it is the same diameter of explosive, like, shell as you see on, like, the grenade launchers mounted underneath a Marine's rifle, but the cartridge is bigger, so it goes, it's longer, so it goes a lot farther. But it is,
you know, the words grenade and cyclic rate were not meant to go near each other. But leave it to a Marine to invent and design that weapon.
Yeah, we had a
simplify.
I didn't know a
Jesse Puller's smiling.
I didn't know a Marine designed it.
Oh yeah, baby.
Really?
A Marine designed that gun and made that. You should be even more proud now.
Okay. That's why it looks like a giant freaking Lego. It makes more sense now. But
you know what's even funnier? The HESCO barriers. You know what those are?
Yes.
So a HESCO barrier, for those who don't, is like it's a mesh sort of box that you put rocks and sand in, and it's an easy way to make sandbags, essentially, or a sandbag wall. Because you can do it with a bulldozer instead of a bunch of privates with shovels. And that was designed by a former Army private who got tired of filling sandbags. It was like, there's got to be a better way. Oh, I love these stories. They make me so happy.
Well, you're a big history buff, aren't you? Because I know Matt had told me that, which, and I want to come back to this later. I don't, but Matt had told me that you guys got to go to Bellowood when they took you over to Germany.
Yeah. They gave me choices of a few places, and I'm super torn because, like, a lot of fun historical things around in the area where we went there in Landstuhl, Germany. But they gave me one day to myself, and then they proceeded to tell me that Bellowood was within a 4-hour drive. And I was like, oh, then that's where we're going. That's the only place we're going. If we go anywhere else afterwards, that's just a bonus. But we're going to Bellowood, and we're staying there as long as I feel like it.
All right. I want to put a pin in that and come back to that, because I've been dying to pick your brain on that. But
totally.
So you went in 2003. You were with 2-5, correct?
Yeah. Joined boot camp October 03. Finally got to my unit about April of 04, and we did about another 6 months of training before we went to Iraq in very, very late August, like the very last week of August of 2004, and September 1st, we took over operations there in Ramadi.
Jeez. And so you were there in the thick of it.
Oh, yeah. We were there. Hooking and jabbing, as they say.
Jeez.
With the bad guys. And, you know, it was rough, but we had more bomb makers and, like, traps to deal with than, like, enemy insurgents. I think they got smart after we smoked a bunch of them. The first week we were there, they did, like, a Vietnam squad rush on our gates, expecting us to be lax or something, and they lost a lot of people that day. And so they just never tried those tactics ever again. It was always like ambush and run away, or bombs, RPGs, quick hits, and then gone, fade away as quickly as they can after that. And so for 2 months, my platoon and I did operations in and around Ramadi, Iraq, where we were doing anything from quick reaction force to, like, daytime, nighttime patrol, guard duty for a week or so, and then back out kind of on that cycle of day, night doing stuff.
And were you guys, because for people, as I had mentioned earlier, you were a cat marine. I was also in a cat platoon. That was a combined anti-armor team. And so that is, you know, traditionally it's heavy machine guns paired with anti-tank missile men in generally, right? And it, so it gets used for quick reaction force kind of stuff. But it also means that, you know, there's a high likelihood of being mounted because it is bare weaponry. But
yeah,
for you guys, I mean, you guys were in Ramadi. Was all like when you guys were patrolling, is that all on foot?
No, we had Humvees.
Okay.
We had up armored Humvees. Say what you will about the early days in Iraq. I had armor and it wasn't armor that we made, which is nice. I even had like a fancy turtle shell around my turret. I felt like I was pimping. Because everybody else had like turtle shell like I did. Yeah.
Wow.
I later went to like Afghanistan on a USO tour and I got to see what guys like in 2011, 2012 were rolling around in. And in comparison, my stuff was a Fabergé egg.
Okay.
To that stuff. Cause it was like the stuff they have now is like steel plated. The stuff I had then was like ceramics with like, you know, it was like, it wasn't made by us, but it was still early technology. So, but it saved my life. That's all
yeah.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I know, obviously I know a lot of guys personally, but I've also had a buddy on here, Justin Martinez, who was in the Army and he was a Motor T guy, and he specifically talked about, and you know, I'd heard this before, but you know, hey, we were stuffing sandbags in the floor of these light skinned Humvees and shoving, like you said, steel plates that we could pull off of anything onto these things, just trying to keep bullets from coming in, and then we'd get hit by a bomb and now all of that stuff shrapnel instead. And it was just no, that's why it shocked me when you said that you guys actually had armor. But and so because you got injured on that first deployment, right?
Yeah 2 months in, we were 8 weeks in, and it was almost exactly 2 months to the day that we were there. I got blown up. It was Halloween of 04. We were doing daytime escort missions. So we were taking like beans, bullets, band-aids, that type of stuff over to some of our Marines that were out in the middle of nowhere. And on the way there, we got a bit of an ambush. No big deal. They basically just shot at us from, you know, from the mosque and from some alleyways and then ran away. And we got to where we were going, we dropped off all of our stuff. And as we came back out, there was this roundabout, like it's probably 200 yards from the gate. And, it was a really pretty roundabout. It had flowers and stuff. It was honestly, it was one of like my favorite parts of the city to like visit every day. And as we drove around it, it exploded. And, that was the first that I'd ever seen that particular flower bed explode. But that was the seventh bomb that hit my vehicle of that deployment. And that bomb went through the rear left passenger vehicle, left passenger door of the vehicle, injuring my A-gunner Kenny, injuring me in the leg. And it unfortunately killed our lieutenant. His name was Matt Lynch. He was from Long Island, New York.
Okay. So that was your platoon commander?
Yeah. He was our platoon commander.
Jeez. And so with that going through the door, was it a shape charge?
Yes.
Okay. They had already adapted to that early.
Yeah, it was a 155. It was one of the first ones we got hit with.
Jeez.
Because everything else that was injuring Marines before that particular explosion was like an RPG went through a weak point in the door, you know, like total fluke sort of stuff, or getting literally shot in the head off a turret, which that.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
One guy got shot in the head, but he survived. He got hit in the Kevlar and it stopped it. It was fine.
Jeez.
She had a bit of a concussion. I think he got to keep the Kevlar, which is funny.
That is insane, dude. I would have that like on my mantle.
I'd sleep under it. Are you kidding me? I'd put it above my bed.
Just wear it out in town. And yeah, I don't know, man. And so that's, you know, so you were up in the turret. Like, had you not, which is kind of in the center of the truck. So had you been down in there, I mean, that could have been you. So
Kenny died a couple of times. He died for 15 minutes and was resuscitated. I got hurt, obviously. I don't fully know all what happened because I was in a coma for a lot of it. So my lungs collapsed. I think I got like pretty close to flatlining once, but never actually did it because the Navy's really good at their job. But my lieutenant, he got hit in the neck with a piece of shrapnel, and it hit his jugular, and he was done before he even knew what happened. Honestly. From what I'm told, I was knocked out at the time, but from what I'm told, he stepped out of the vehicle and started trying to command Marines like, "Hey, you go over here and do this and you do that." And as he started trying to do that, he kind of fell over and passed out.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah. And then, they pulled me out of the Humvee. I woke up sort of inside the Humvee, sitting down, which was weird. I'd been blown up a bunch, and I'd never actually been knocked on my butt before. So I like tried to stand back up, put my right leg under me. Everything seemed to be okay. And then my left, as I like pulled myself up with my arms and with my right leg under me, it felt like my left foot was stuck like in the e-brake.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm going on pure instinct and training at this point. I'm just trying to get back up under my gun to like lay down covering fire.
Yeah.
And so as I'm pulling up, I'm like, why won't my leg move? And I look down and it's bent in a way that it normally doesn't bend. And I went, okay, that's going to leave a mark. So I laid back down and we called for a medic, and Doc Hulata came in, pulled everybody out of the Humvee, pulled me out, popped me full of morphine, which, let me just say to your audience, I recommend highly if you're ever traumatically in that fashion. It was amazing. I mean, don't go chasing the dragon, but if you're ever hurt that bad, I went from agonizing pain to just being okay and high-fiving my buddies. It was the wildest experience ever.
Jesus Christ. Like, dude, you see my fucking foot? Look at that. Yeah.
So I was telling my boys, I'll be back in a couple weeks, huh? I was loopy.
Well, and I mean, your brain, like, did you have a TBI from that?
I'm pretty sure, yes, I have a traumatic brain injury. I don't know if it's from that one or from the six before that.
Yeah.
Or the fucking five or six that blew up in front or behind my vehicle, because my brain didn't feel good after any one of those.
Weird how that works.
I know, it's weird. But I woke up in the hospital and it had been a week had gone by. I'd been in a coma and I was in Maryland and my parents and my siblings were in my room. I was like, did I fucking die? My mom and my dad are in the same, they've been divorced since I was 8. They haven't been in the same zip code, let alone room, since that time. I'm like, mom, dad, Jesus, where are you? I really thought I was dead. And then they calmly informed me that I was in Maryland. And I was like, oh, so the military didn't fly you to Iraq? Okay, that's a relief. And then, yeah, man, that's when the recovery began. I've got, my leg was in shambles. There was like an inch and a half of bone and nerve and skin and stuff just missing. Wow. I had an external fixator is what they call it, which is big, like black metal steel rings that have little rods going in and out of your skin, holding stuff together.
I've seen those things before. Those look just like those. Used to make me cringe when I'd see pictures of that stuff. Like
they look cringe, but I was really grateful to have mine because it let me walk on that leg with a walker for the first time in months.
Really?
Yeah, because it's like the structure of the metal part keeps everything in place, so you can bear weight on it. You just got like you. Obviously, you're not going to be going for a run or anything, but you can like kind of shuffle around with a walker and stuff. And I've got videos of me like going to the bathroom pictures of me going to the bathroom for the first time wearing that external fixator. Let me tell you, man, nobody's ever been happier to get up and go take a dump in their life. I promise you. I was so excited. I was so happy.
I don't know. I can definitely identify with that. They had, after I shot myself, they had like all the meds and everything. And from me being on life support, like I was so stopped up. They had tried like industrial grade laxatives. And then I'd have a male nurse come in and put in a freaking suppository. And like that wouldn't work. And so like, I get it, man. That's not a...
I've got a fun suppository story.
Oh, please do.
Well, so as I'm getting off all the medications that have amputated my leg at this point, my mom is there and my nurse is a male nurse and he is a former linebacker for the USC Trojans.
Big old hands.
Dude, he's 6'5". His hands are giant. Okay. And I was just like, hey man, my mom is right here. Can you just tell her how to do the thing and like let her do it for me? Because you're so big, you're so black. Like
I got you, brother.
And he goes, brother, I totally understand. I get it. He goes, I could go get a pretty nurse, but I get it. I'll go with your mom. And I was like, sweet. So he tells my mom how to do it. My mom's like, whatever, dude. I've been giving kids suppositories since before you were born, stupid. And so she goes to put it in, and I didn't realize this at the time, but my mom has very big, strong fingers from a lifetime of working in restaurants, so her hands are about as big as a linebacker's.
The big old arthritic knuckles.
Yeah, man. Dude. Oh, mom, she stretched me out. But that's the thing that worked. They tried everything else, and the suppository was the only thing that actually got me going. How about you?
Think.
I was just thinking,
like, man, how close you and your mom must be now. Like, that's pretty cool, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Me and my mom have always been super close.
Yeah, I don't know.
But ever since the first suppository, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just, okay, it's weird how that works. It's just having so many just strong insights here. Thank you for the wisdom as always. But so I guess with that, did they amputate while you were out?
Yes. I was unconscious. Not in the coma. I kept my leg for about 2 months And then after 2 months of fighting, we finally epiphated.
Jeez. So, did you just have a bunch of surgeries?
Oh, shit. I'm 38.
Today. Oh, my God.
Yeah. What, 38 today? There was like 36 before final amputation. No, the 37th was the amputation.
How long? Go ahead.
3 months. 3 months of every other day going into surgery.
Wow.
To clean this or do that or whatever. And it just...
Does it just not always take? Is it like sometimes all we left, some bone here is cutting through the skin? Like, what is that?
For the first couple of weeks, it was literally just going in to clean and make sure that there was no infection and make sure that everything was growing correctly. But I had to go under for it. Like, they had to put me under I don't know if you've been through surgery. So anybody that's never had to be, you're not allowed to eat for 8 hours prior to your thing, or anything solid for 8 hours prior to your thing. And then before that, it's like 24 hours. I don't know. All I know was that I was starved for a day. I would go into surgery. I would be able to eat when I came out of surgery, but I didn't want to eat because I was on drugs. And then by the end of the day, I'd be able to get a full meal in me. And then at midnight, I had to stop eating because I had surgery the day after.
Jeez.
And it was just that. It was that. Every day.
Yeah. And they cut your liquids too. So like on top of that, you're dehydrated, I would imagine, in an ungodly amount of pain, and they're doping you constantly.
Eating ice chips and shit.
Jeez.
Brutal.
And that was 3 months of that. And that's just the hospital stay. I mean, I would imagine when you got out of there, you're still not walking. I mean, can you?
Oh, no, I was amputated, and they send you home for like 3 months to heal, just so all of your sutures get all good. And once I was healed, they sent me to San Antonio, and pretty quick.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Quickly after that, I got a leg. I was happy as hell when they finally amputated my leg, dude. I can't really describe how happy I was to be rid of a limb. It was weird because I was balding on the back of my head by the end of it from being in a hospital bed for so long. I was finally free. I could like hop around the house. I didn't have this giant metal thing attached to me at all times with that was essentially trying to save this dead leg that was probably not going to get any function out of it anyway. So it was very freeing when I went home to heal. I was like, I got really good at hopping around. I'm still really good at it. I got a bulletproof knee. I can still do single leg squats like it's going out of style.
That's crazy. The balance that takes is freaking nuts.
Yeah. And I can do it. I do it with like a backpack on when I'm out in the airport and stuff just to mess with people and show the wusses. But yeah, it, it, It's hard to describe how freeing of an experience it was. It was awesome. And then getting my leg was even better. You know, they give you a prosthetic and they're like, hey, don't, you know, try not to wear it for longer than like an hour or two at a time. You might chafe or you might get a sore. And I took it home and I didn't take it off for like 3 days, dude. I just wore it constantly. I learned how to two-step at Cowboys Dance Hall Scarpin. I went, wow, you can't tell a young Marine nothing.
Yeah, well, I'm sure, you know, you got a freaking war hero with one leg at the bars tearing it up. Like, geez, was there like that relief though? And that, you know, it sounds like it was that positive feeling of it. Was that like an artificial, like, not artificial, an initial release? I would imagine, like, was there that, and then all, like, it dropped off as reality set in and you're like, holy shit, part of my leg's gone? Or were you just kind of on the move and
waking up without a leg for the first time was jarring?
Yeah,
I'm not gonna say that it wasn't. You know, you wake up, you open your eyes, and you see one foot underneath your covers. And what's left is just like this stump of what used to, you know, it just goes, it stops at the calf. And so that was a pretty memorable, like, holy shit, it's gone.
Yeah.
And then almost immediately afterwards, it was like, okay, well, this is reality. This is life. What are we doing now? Let's move on. Let's figure this shit out. I'd had other Marines who were in the hospital with me who, like, they lost their leg in Iraq or Afghanistan, woke up without a limb, healed up, were hanging out with me, and then they left and then came back to visit me while I was still going through surgeries, and they're like on a prosthetic leg walking around. I was so ready.
Yeah, you know, I forget about that aspect of it. Like, I know. He's legally blind. He has like central vision in one eye and peripheral in the other. Is a force recon Marine who got blown up, and he was in the hospital for like a year. And like a huge part of, you know, part of that was all of the crazy surgeries they had to do to his head and his face. But like he's talked about that where, yeah, you're in there and he was almost like a, he's a Marine that's there also for the other. And that's part of, that's because it's his personality, right? Like he's that kind of human being. But like, you know, you forget that you're not alone in there. Like, you know, and I do say to sitting here listening to this, that, yeah, obviously there's other service members in there who might be a little farther along than you are, who are there to help kind of, I guess, be someone who can understand what you're going through.
It's not just that. It's like, not only is there people that understand exactly what you're going through, because there's, at the time that I was going through it, there was like two or three other amputees that were in the same boat, quite literally, whether it be the leg or opposite leg, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then there's two dozen others that are in various levels of disabled now, you know what I mean? They're above the knee on their leg, or missing two legs below the knee, two legs above the knee, one leg above, one leg below, one's missing a hand, two missing, or one guy's missing two hands. I had a buddy named Dusty. Dusty was missing two legs, one above the knee, one below. He was missing one hand and all but two fingers on the other hand. He was a burn victim. He was a Cav Scout, Army dude, one of the hardest dudes I've ever met in my life. Just never complained. Just a tough son of a gun. And I think I was complaining about something dumb. Like just something so trivial and dumb about my leg and chafing and whatever. We're sitting outside and I go, it's frustrating. You know what I mean, man? Dusty looks at me and he goes, bro, I haven't jerked off in like a year. Get over it. As he lights a cigarette, he's holding a Zippo with the hook and he lights it with the one finger of the two that he has on one hand. He lights his cigarette and he just says that fucking gem at me. It's really hard to feel sorry for yourself in these places because there's dudes like that walking around.
Yeah, it puts things into perspective. It keeps you in check a little bit. Like, wow, it gave me the chills. Honestly, like when you told me, like, you know, the extent of his injuries, and it's just like,
yeah,
like, fuck, man, just like he said, that's a hard motherfucker.
Just, and the happiest dude ever. Just nice, just awesome. And then, so it gets really hard for me to like feel sorry for myself a lot of the times. And don't get me wrong, I do. Everybody does. Everybody gets out of themselves, right? But it's about being really, really grateful for everything that you do have, regardless of how little it might be.
Yes.
And I call it radical gratitude. Cause it's like, it's the kind of gratitude that immigrants have. Like my mom, like this, her dad died when she was like 12. She had to support her entire 9 sibling household by herself. Cause my grandmother didn't work. And, I grew up with that lady as my mom. And she was just always like, she was a waitress. She was raising 4 kids on just a waitress's salary in LA. And she never was like depressed or sad or ever upset about it. She was always just like, hey, we're gonna watch a movie tonight, and we're gonna dance, and we're gonna turn. Like, she was just, yes, she was tired at times, but she was always just grateful for life and breath, and that really rubbed off on me. But also with all of the other examples of the warriors around me, it was like,
it really is. Like, it sounds corny, but like when you stop, if you objectively think about it, it is true, right? Like, obviously there's, you know, people get chemical imbalances in their brains and there's other things that keep them from being able to just be, you know, that play into your mind getting to a bad place. But like in a very simple way, you know, abstracting away all of those things, like, perspective is everything. And a lot of the time that is a choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's Winston Churchill, I think, said, comparison is the thief of joy. And I just think that's bullshit, because I compare my life to a lot of people and it does not steal my joy whatsoever. If nothing, it makes me more joyful for being alive, because I compare my life to child soldiers in Africa, or people who grew up without fathers in third world countries, people who grew up without family, orphans who grew up here, poor, you know, people who can't feed their children, people who can't, it just, it's only the thief of joy if you're hoping that your life is, I don't know how to say it more concisely than
yeah.
Compare yourself with a Kardashian.
Yeah. And even that, it's, you know, it's, even if you choose to compare yourself to someone who is better off than you, like, sometimes that's fuel. Like, again, it's how you're looking at it, right? It's like, no, that's freaking motivating. Like, I want to be like that guy, as opposed to, oh, I want what that person has, like, but I don't want to work for it, kind of thing. I think it's all, you know, generalities are generally dangerous. Like, with it's hard, you know. I'm sure that quote was taken out of context, but it does, I don't know, perspective, something I hone on. And I've never heard the radical gratitude thing. I like that, though, because it is, like, I've talked about that a lot. So many things in life are a choice, even though we like to throw other things into the equation where that would offload some of the responsibility that we have, like the individual responsibilities that we have in, you know, making it so that we can try and explain something is not entirely being a choice. And it's not always a choice, but I do, at the end of the day, is what you focus on. Like you said, the things that you can do and not the things that you can't.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
And that's, yeah, perspective and can really be a game changer in the way you live life and the way you pursue things. Anyway, I don't know. Moving on.
You're good. Yeah. So when, you know, all said and done, because hospital, 3 months, they send you home for a little bit. You go to San Antonio. And then what happened? I know earlier you mentioned that you got back into music. Like, but even how does that work? Like, did you ever, after you have your prosthetics and stuff, because honestly, I've never gotten to talk to someone about this. You know,
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Told you before we started recording, you know, I typically, unless I either one, know someone very well personally, or two, like someone's combat is something that is like some like a huge part of their story, and like you as a professional speaker, you talk about it all the time. Like, I don't bring it up. Yeah. Not being a combat vet, I feel like that is not my place. But so, you know, I've never gotten to ask someone about this part. Like, when it all was said and done, you're walking in, you have your prosthetic and you're out there, like, do you return to uniform and they process you out, or how did all that work?
Yeah, it depends on where you were in the hospital. Cause like when I was in San Antonio, they basically, once they gave me my prosthetic and I was like cleared for light duty, they like once a week I had to go into the Marine liaison office and answer a phone. That was my job. I would put on camis, roll my sleeves up, and walk my little happy one-legged butt into their office and sit there for 4 hours and answer the phone. Good afternoon, sir, ma'am, Lance Corporal Gonzalez, Office of Marine Liaison, how may I help you? You know what I mean? Like, it was simple as that. And then as soon as I was done, they like out-processed me from right there in the hospital. It was the early days of guys retiring out in that fashion. So like my process was probably unlike any others once they got like that pipeline set up, because they basically gave me my walking papers and said, see you, kid, have a good day.
Don't let the door hit you on the way out, kind of.
Yeah, no, thanks for your service. Take this to the VA. Have a great one.
God. And that's actually, I did not realize this until we were at that storytelling workshop and I was talking to you and Matt. I think that those of you who were combat wounded and medically retired as a result don't get a military pension. And I know that is starting to hopefully change with this Major Richard Starr Act, but I don't think anyone who's not been combat wounded and medically retired knows that. I've always assumed that that was the case. Right? Like, logically, it seems like someone who signed that dotted line should get those benefits if an injury sustained at war prevents them from being able to continue serving their time.
Yeah, but even that Major Richard Starr Act is different, because it's we get a retirement paycheck from the VA. It's a retirement compensation, but it's not, it's a disability. It's not like your retirement pay. You know what I mean?
Okay.
The Major Richard Starr Act is, let's say you served two deployments, you were, or two enlistments, so 8 years minimum, and you got injured, and you want to take some, like, some of the money that you put into your retirement from the military, you can get that back now with the Major Richard Starr Act.
Okay.
It's not for guys like me. I was only in for 4 years, so I wouldn't even qualify for that.
Okay. I misunderstood, I guess, on both ends with that. There's, you know, some of the nuances of it, but like still that.
I'm still learning about it myself. This is all, and I'm in the, you know, the veteran world. So yeah. It's not surprising that it's not super well known about, but it, I think, you know, I don't know. There's some people that love it. There's some people that hate it, but it is what it is. I don't really have an opinion because it doesn't affect me one way or the other.
Yeah. I just, either way, it caught me off guard. Like I just, my expectations there, I guess, had been shattered a little bit. I just assumed that you guys were entirely taken care of, but is.
You would assume that. You would assume that. No, we're not. The government sucks. But the Warrior Project is a thing.
Yes. Which is so, yeah, that just, it's blown my mind knowing that. And that's. You know, I know you mentioned earlier when you first got out, you dove into music, not that you hadn't already been doing that your entire life, but at what, when did you get involved with Wounded Warrior Project? Like as a, I guess, just in general, yeah.
The day I came out of my coma, they were at my bedside. They gave me a backpack and they were like, hey, if you ever need anything, let us know. And they kept that promise. Throughout the years, if I ever needed anything, they were like, yeah, they tried to make it happen or tried to connect with somebody that could make it happen. And it wasn't until like 2011, I needed a job. I got back from a USO tour in Afghanistan. And my day job had fired me while I was gone.
Sick.
And I was like, all right, I get it. No worries. I'd been gone playing music for quite a while at that point. And so I walked myself into the Wounded Warrior Project office and I said, hey, I have no skills. I've worked in bars and I know how to shoot machine guns real good. But I need a job and I need somebody to help me write my resume. And they said, okay. And so there's a whole program with Wounded Warrior Project called Warriors to Work, where they'll have a person sit down with you. They'll find out your work history. They'll find out your education level. They'll write all of it down properly the way it's supposed to be done in a. Why am I drawing a blank on the word now? Resume. And they'll help you find a job in the area that you want to get a job in, whether that's just coaching you and helping you like get interviews places or working with one of our partners that just, they say, hey, if you got somebody that wants to be in this field, we're going to hire them right off the bat. You know what I mean? And so they'll, that sort of a thing. She wrote out my resume and she goes, funny enough, you might actually be perfect for a job here at Wounded Warrior Project. Do you have a fear of public speaking? And I said, sister, I haven't been afraid of freaking in Pullman since I was 4. Let's do it.
Wow.
I have this superpower that I call not having shame, because I will be up on stage. I will act a fool and not, I do not care if I embarrass myself. So yeah, it's worked out well in this career.
Well, it was obviously, I got to hear you speak. You're very, very short speech during that workshop, but I was really blown away. I got to see throughout the week you guys critiquing all of us giving our speeches, and like you and Matt, it was weird. It was like, you know, it's the panel of you two, like it's like American Idol or something, but it was very just on the spot. You're like, hey man, you took 6 minutes to tell this story that I could have said in these two sentences. Here it is. Also, you know, X, Y, and Z, you can tighten that up. Also, maybe move this section to the beginning. And it was just, I was like, holy shit, these dudes are professionals, right? Like it is a lot more than just, yeah, I can get up here and tell my story for 30 minutes or whatever it is. It was just, it's really stuck with me. And I've gone back and listened to those videos from you guys critiquing me because I don't know.
You got to do the work. You got to do the work. You got to watch the videos. You got to do the work. You gotta watch tape. It's the most uncomfortable part of the process, but you got to do it.
Yeah. It's been so, I don't know, that program, if anyone else is listening, who participates with the Wounded Warrior Project, was the storytelling workshop, which I know is super, sounds like few and far in between and also highly sought after. So I don't know if maybe
it's a mixture of both. Some people, there's a lot of people that just don't care for it because it's public speaking. Like who wants to, it's the biggest public fear there is like public speaking for some reason.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people that don't want to do it, but then there's a lot of people that do want to do it because they feel like you, that they have a story that could help somebody. Yeah. And I'm always encouraging of them to tell. I'm encouraging of everybody to tell their story. Even if you're not going to go on a stage and tell the story, learn how to tell the story just so you can tell your kids.
Well, and I think it also is an indicator of I am okay with where I'm at. You know, it's at least a vessel to get there, right? If you can say that stuff aloud to other people like that every time you do that, you are processing them. So like me not knowing that talking about my story in a very specific way makes me cry like a baby when you're there, like that screwed me up, man. Coming back where I was like, I thought I was over some of this stuff. And
same with me. I was like 5 or 6 years removed from my injury at that point. Like I told my story a lot.
Yeah.
But when you start going through the training and start like really digging in and trying to be real and connect with people and really explain what it was like, you just start bawling. You're like, oh, I have not dealt with that stuff. And the further I got, I mean, I'm 13 years into this game of working for Wounded Warrior Project and helping people tell their stories and telling my story. And I'm still finding new parts of my story that make me vulnerable and get me like tearful and stuff on stage. It's wild. It's wild.
That's terrifying because I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll get to the point where I can talk about those parts where it doesn't tear me up, but okay. Maybe not. There's always that.
What's funny is that you get past the initial hurdle. It's like an initial hump of learning how to talk about it without falling the fuck apart. And then you learn to tell the story. You tell the story, beginning to end, and you don't have a problem telling the story. But then you realize that, yeah, even though you've been telling the story, there's a level of real that you share with the world, and then there's the level of real that you keep to yourself.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I started talking about my survivor's guilt and all that stuff that I started realizing just how much that affected me.
Yeah.
Because like before that, I was just talking about losing my leg and dealing with the aftermath of that. And then like, I talked a little bit about survivor's guilt.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact. And redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
But it was never like, I never expanded on that or why I felt that way. I always just kind of left it to my music to tell how I felt about that.
Yeah.
Got a song called Heroes, by the way, shameless plug, out everywhere.
Check it out on peglegsongs.com.
Peglegs. Get yourself a t-shirt and some chucks.
Maybe a video of him taking his first shit after getting blown up.
Yeah, it's just a still. It's a photo where he walking out of the bathroom, have feeling lighter than air.
okay. Oh, dude, actually, I've got some hospital pictures right here. Look, this is me and Adam Sandler.
Thank you for showing me.
Rob Schneider. Yeah, I want to show you so you can see. You get celebrities that come through on occasion to Bethesda, Maryland, especially at the time, and they would like come and visit us in the hospital. And being a big musician, they were like, they had Henry Rollins come through, but I was like just coming out of surgery. So I was like, she's still in a coma, all fucked up. And so Henry Rollins left me a Polaroid that says, "Sal, hey man, Henry Rollins." And it's just a picture of him looking like a fucking hostage. It's so funny.
What?
Yeah. Because they're like, no, he plays music. He's going to love that you stop. It's so funny. It's the dumbest thing ever.
That's hilarious. And he's like, look, I wanted to come here to try and help. And now I don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, dude. It's so funny.
Oh.
I feel bad for the dude.
Yeah. You know, it's something else we had talked about. I don't even remember how it came up. It was specifically, you were guiding me somewhere when we were down in Colorado Springs, and I mentioned being insecure about the fact that I'm not a combat vet. And you had mentioned that you felt that way for a while, or maybe even you do now, because it was like, oh, you hadn't seen enough combat. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. Here's what I tell people. You know, I served with some real hard chargers, and a lot of these people that I served with that are my friends and my heroes and the people that I look upon when I think of like veterans and people that serve, some of these guys have 4, 5, 6 deployments under their belts. You know what I mean? Like, they served their country. I was in the Marine Corps for 1 year and 10 days when I got injured. Jeez. I had a cup of coffee in the Marine Corps. I cosplayed as a tough guy for 1 year. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
and still to an extent, even after all the therapy and stuff, and I understand the rational part of my brain knows this is not true, but there's still a piece of me that's like, no, I'm not like those guys. I'm not like them.
That's so crazy.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
It's hard for me to understand. Like, I get what you're saying, but it is just like, I wonder what is that in people? Like,
that's imposter syndrome, dude. It's imposter syndrome. It just is what it is. It's everybody that's done anything is like, do I really deserve, you know what I mean? Like, people say I'm a good singer all the time. I really don't believe it. I say it. I put that intention out into the world, but every time I hear myself sing in a recording, I hate it. It's like nails on a chalkboard.
It just might
be because I hate myself, but
I was going to say healthy ego, but it's, you do. Yeah. You probably just hate yourself, man. That's probably, you're probably right. But, so, I mean,
I blame my dad. I think he didn't hug me enough.
I meant to ask you earlier, and I told you I wanted to ask you about the Bellawood thing, and then I'll let you out of here. I know I've kept you longer than I intended to, so I apologize, but, you know, this, I also didn't know that this program existed. So what is it like, Matt And Matt Schultz is who I've said this last couple of times when I've mentioned Matt. So that's another employee at Wounded Warrior Project. But
yeah, he's my boss. He's in charge of the Warrior Speak program. He and as part of those duties, he's in charge of the storytelling workshops. So we help teach not only warriors, but our employees, especially like warrior-facing employees, employees that deal with warriors on a day-to-day basis. We teach them how to tell their stories because a lot of times they're veterans. And in order to connect with other veterans, you have to talk to them and tell them. And if you're not comfortable talking about your story and your service, the veterans that you serve will never trust you in that sort of a way. So if you open communication by, you know, talking about yourself and being comfortable talking about yourself, a lot of times this leads to better relationships and better just interactions in general. So we started with just employees, and then we figured out that warriors that were employees were like, dude, this is beneficial on like a mental health level. You guys should open this up to warriors. And we thought it was a great idea. So we've been doing that for a while now. And we're seeing really good results. We have guys like yourself, guys and gals go through this a couple of times a year, and we've gotten zero negative feedback from it. All of it's been very positive, and I do honestly believe in the power of storytelling, how it can be healing and stuff, and. That's how I got sent to Germany. They're like, hey, we're teaching a speaking class. We have a big group of warriors out there. You can teach them. You'll have 5 days teaching them. And then we're going to do 5 days of you speaking at different places. You'll get to go. I got to go to Launchdale, Germany and speak on the flight line. I got to go hang out and see how the wounded are transported back and forth. I got to go to the hospital and see where I was initially transported and held in the ICU. I got to visit with a few soldiers that were there in the hospital from Ukraine. And then I played a couple of shows at the USO right there in Launchdual for a bunch of the Ukrainian vets, as well as, you know, our own troops.
That's freaking cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Most of them didn't speak English, but they all enjoyed the music regardless. And then one of them was Colombian and he spoke Spanish. And so I was able to talk to him, and he was just some Colombian dude. Like, he was a Colombian Army Special Forces guy, and he was getting ready to retire from Colombia. And the war in Ukraine kicked off. He's like, there's another war. Off. Just went. He's dude. You want to talk about wild war stuff.
Savage is what that is. Like, that is just a hard human being.
Dude, they're talking about trench warfare. And like, I'm so grateful that I didn't have to go to war in the age of drones.
Well, and it's weird because it is a mix between old, like, World War One style
trench warfare.
Trench and attrition warfare. And then you have that, the crazy technology at the same time.
Yeah, it's cyberpunk and World War One. Sure, I extend to one. Try to come up with like a pop culture equivalent, and I can't quite do it.
Yeah, and it's probably tough because I can't see either. So like, you're like, well, it looks like, but I bought it specifically with that because I mean, I'm sure that was. If you remember anything from Germany, it was probably powerful, but. Bellowwood, man, that is, and for people who don't know, that is where the Marine Corps, the devil dog thing, which it comes from the term Teufelhündin, which was a, like, that all came from Bellowwood. Yep. Bunch of Marines went through there and ripped up, just annihilated everyone, and they found in an old journal that, you know, someone had compared, like, the Marines there, they come at us like hounds from hell, these Teufelhunden. And that is where that are, like, the namesake of Del Dog all came from. And you got to go there on that trip to Germany. I mean, that's in France, but what was that like?
That was wild. You get there and there's like a little house that you go in that's the museum that tells you the story of the battle and how, like, hour by hour, what happened and how that took place. And
right next to that little museum, there's the Devil Dog Fountain. That's a little, it's like a bulldog head made of stone, and it shoots water out into this fountain. And it said that if a Marine drinks out of that fountain, they'll add 10 years to their life. So I drank. And then you go to the actual, like, Bella Wood, like the monument, right? And the front side is what you would picture of like a World War One monument. You walk up and it's all very majestic, and there's like a tall monument building thing. And then there's just a sea of crosses in both directions, as far as you can see. Jeez. And then if you have two legs, you can walk from there off into the actual wood line. But me and Matt, we jumped back in the car and we drove around to the other side, actually into the woods, because they have like a driving path that goes through the middle of the woods, and they have a bunch of walking paths that they've created that go all the way through the woods. And it's like a national park. It's just like you would have here, with little nature trails and mile markers and everything. Kilometer markers for them, dirty commies. Spent talking smack on metric. It's crazy, man, because when you're driving up to the wood, when I pictured the woods, I pictured a forest.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Like, as far as the eye could see, forest in either direction. I'm thinking Verdun, you know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking the Romans fighting the Germans and losing the Eagle Standard, like in the middle of the woods. This is not the case. Okay. Most of this part of France is farmland. So it's mostly like wheat fields. The Belle Wood is really only like an island of woods in a sea of wheat.
Huh.
And so when the Marines assaulted it back in World War II, 200 Marines from 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines attacked the wood line. And out of 200 Marines, 5 made it. And along with help from the American Army, the French Army, and other Marine units that were there, they took the Belle Wood. They took the woods from the Germans. It took the Germans 6 months to take that wood line. It took us all of 6 days to take it back.
I didn't know 5 Marines survived that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
The French were getting ready to pull out. They were like, hey, listen, thank you guys for showing up. We appreciate you guys being here to reinforce us, but we're going to go back to Paris and we're going to hold them at Paris. And my unit, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, got there, and the commander was like, retreat? Hell, we just got here, boys.
Yeah, retreat hell. That's where that came from.
2-5, retreat hell. That's my unit's motto. So that was really cool for me to get to go and like see the lineage of 2-5 Marines from back then. But the whole time I'm like walking in the wheat field towards the wood line, I'm like, I'm having panic attacks just thinking about German machine guns. And think about it, you're walking in this wood line. There's concealment, but no cover. And you have a bolt action rifle in your hands. You're walking through mustard gas and all sorts of nasty stuff with a cloth gas mask on. It's made of canvas. And there's German machine guns shooting at you. It's really hard not to have a panic attack when you're like trying to picture yourself as one of those young
guys. Yes. Well, and people like, which is, this is actually a lot of our like machine gun doctrine kind of came from theirs. Like it was, they were so effective at building these fields of fire and these channeling with different obstacles and obstructions, channeling people into these just death pits. Like, yep. And so everything that is, as they're traversing this terrain, they are getting funneled into these kill zones, which it's interlocking fields of fire between different machine guns. And it's just, it was, I mean, five guys came out, right? Like, obviously it was a slaughterhouse, but it is all engineered to be that. And it's just this meat grinder with a caveman technology while you're getting ripped apart by these things. And it is still, that's, gosh, man. Yeah. Going there. I mean, I was curious. It was interesting that you said that about it being almost this like independent set of, you know, trees and woods that are there. Cause I was going to ask you if it was like real, I had pictured it as being super thick, like the Pacific Northwest almost. I don't know why, but
no, it's not. It's mostly farmland. Now, once you get into the woods, it is very hard to see through. It is very Pacific Northwesty. It's okay. Like any forest that you would walk through when you're in it. But up until you get into it, it's just farmland. It's probably 2 miles square.
Just
of just woods. And then everything else around it is farmland. So it makes sense that the Germans would set up there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know you said it almost like made you anxious being there and like trying to put yourself in their shoes. I've been to like when you go to Arlington National Cemetery or like the Holocaust Museum, there's this like ominous air to the place. Was it like that?
Only because I'm a Marine.
Okay.
And honestly, I don't know, man. I don't know if a civilian would have the same sort of insights that I had when I was there. Cause it's like, there's a certain sound that a bullet makes when it cracks near your head. You know what I mean? There's a certain taste and feeling and it brought back a lot of sensations that I didn't think would be brought back. But because again, I'm you know, I have experience in that realm. I'm walking through and I'm like hunching over, just looking, and I'm like, oh, just imagining the crack of a bullet go over your head and you having to dive into this like muddy water that's made by craters. That's another thing. You're walking through the woods and there's just these bomb craters everywhere.
From them dropping artillery shells and stuff.
Artillery, mortars. And yeah, man, it's crazy. I stole a piece of wood. I have a nice long chunk of branch of wood from Bella Wood that I brought with me.
Wow. That is so...
I think it's technically illegal, but I figured what are the French going to do to me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Come at him. Come get him.
Don't come at me.
Don't do it.
I love you people. I love the French. Yeah. As Americans, you're taught or you're kind of told that the French are rude and mean people towards Americans very specifically. And then I went there and everybody was the nicest ever. All the people that served me food were amazing. All the people that gave us directions where we needed to go were great. The people that worked at the museums were fantastic. They were all super grateful. They were all like, oh, you're Americans. Thank you so much. We really appreciate. Oh, you're a Marine. Oh, that's even better. Like they hug you. It's crazy how loving the French people are. And then I was talking to somebody in Landstuhl about it. I was like, it's so crazy how nice the French are. They get a really bad rap. And they're like, yeah, well, that's because most people go to like Paris.
I was going to say like, Parisians have a horrible like, you know, stereotype of being rude.
Yeah. And he goes, that's like judging that's like going to America and judging everybody by New York and LA.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm like, that makes sense. That makes a lot more sense now. I get it. So if I ever gave the French grief, I apologize.
let's setting the record straight on this massive, massive podcast.
I just want, hey, listen, man, Joe Rogan numbers one day. I know it.
Yeah.
Well, man.
You're the next Sean Ryan. You're going to be the blind Sean Ryan.
Yeah. Once my OnlyFans gets up, it's game over, man.
You got to take pictures of your junk. That's what makes it happen.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to get the angle right, you know? Yeah. So.
Because then they're just taking pictures of your feet. That'll get you money in some circles, too.
Yeah.
But, so.
Yeah, I would know, but I come at half price.
Yeah. We got peglegsongs.com. It's the record is called Sal Gonzalez by Sal Gonzalez.
At Sal G Music on all things social media.
Okay. What else can I do? You speak outside of Wounded Warrior Project? Can people reach out to you about that?
Yeah. If anybody wants me to come speak, I can do like a full 40-minute keynote if need be. I love what I do at Wounded Warrior Project, and I'll continue to do it even after my music career, if it ever takes off and I get to be a touring, you know, only doing music musician sort of a thing. Even then, I'll probably still be working for Wounded Warrior Project a couple times a year, because I love the organization. It's a great organization. It's great, full of great people, and I'm lucky to have found them.
Yes.
Have been found by them.
And the culture there is, you know, as a someone who's on the outside participating in a lot of this stuff, the adaptive sports stuff, you know, some of these other like workshops and mental health things, and getting to do some volunteering with them, like, it is, the culture there is special. It's different. And I think it opens the door for a lot of these deeper conversations happen. You know, like we had some heavy conversations during that workshop with everybody there. Everyone there opened up in a way that you don't typically. And I think it is specifically because of the way that, like, yes, everyone's very professional on the staff, but you also don't act. It seems like there's an intentional effort to act like normal human beings and not from a place of power or have the like stuffy corporate facade on things. And it's just, for people listening, it is all post 9/11 veterans. You don't have to be combat wounded. I'm not combat wounded. I'm not a combat vet. And there's so many more resources than everything else that we've talked about. But what else do you need to plug, put out there, other than what we've already said?
Sal G Music and all things social media. I do a weekly Twitch stream on Sunday nights that I call Cover Song Sunday, starting at 9 p.m. Central, where I play music and take requests. I do covers and I sing some of my own stuff and I tell stories about the songs and all that sort of thing. It's just fun. I just like doing it. And then I once I'm done with that, I usually play video games and you guys can watch me suck at that. So I'm good at two things in life: shooting machine guns and playing music. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds super cool, man. Hopefully this drives some people that way. But, you know, I'm sure people are going to be checking out your record November 10th. This will be out before then. I will have links to your website in the show notes, even though we've said it 12 times.
Yeah, and we'll have pre-sales and all that stuff too here soon. So
okay.
As soon as I get those links, I'll send them over to you.
Sweet, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, brother. I appreciate you. Hopefully we'll see you soon. We got to go golfing with Mark up in Ohio.
Yes. Yeah. Him and I talked. I can fill you in on that. But thanks everyone for listening to another episode. I haven't checked the time. I'm pretty sure this is the longest one that we've ever done. So thanks for sticking around. Please, again, take a second to go rate and review the show wherever you're listening. Follow the show and also share this conversation around with people who need to hear it before heading over to my website at zachtidwell.com and joining my mailing list so you can get updates about my book as I have more information to give to you. We'll see you next time.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.